Hi there, I'm Kim Vanel. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera. Your look at the world of business and economics. This week, Angela Merkel's legacy. Germany's economy is the envy of the world, but its economic position is under threat, unprepared for the digital age. Can the next leader of Germany take on its challenges? Lies and fabrications. A war of words as game maker Epic has kicked off the Apple App Store until all legal disputes have been settled. Is Apple abusing its monopoly power? And a slow motion economic collapse. International buyers are shunning Afghan businesses. Firms are struggling to stay afloat, forcing them to lay off employees. German voters have had their say. The Social Democrats won the most votes and now start the process of forming a government, ending 16 years of conservative-led rule under Angela Merkel. Whatever the makeup of the new government, it has a huge task ahead, leading the world's fourth biggest economy. Merkel oversaw a huge transformation of the economy. Once the sick man of Europe, the country weathered the North Atlantic financial crisis and the Great Recession better than its neighbours. For many, Germany is the envy of the world, an export juggernaut with its world-beating motor industry and the lowest debt burden of any G7 nation. And therein lies many of its problems. The auto industry for a long time dismissed Tesla as a niche and stubbornly pushed diesel. That was until the car makers admitted to cheating environmental tests. Now, Tesla is worth $766 billion. That's more than twice as much as BMW, Daimler and Volkswagen combined. As they spend billions of dollars rolling out electric cars, 215,000 jobs could be lost because there's no need for complicated combustion engines. That's almost a quarter of the number of people employed directly by the auto industry. Now, that belated investment has been reflected in other areas of the economy. While its research and development spending ranks highly, its spending on digitization, artificial intelligence and broadband has a lot to be desired. In a ranking of the world's most innovative countries seen here, Germany props up the top 10 countries. But the auto industry has also enabled the country to record trade surpluses with other countries. And that hasn't gone unnoticed by trading partners, because that worsens their economic problems. But it's Germany's exports to China which are causing the most concern, leaving the country dependent on the communist country and unwilling to confront Beijing's human rights abuses. All of this trade means the country doesn't need to turn to the financial markets to borrow money to run the country. Since the financial crisis, the country has implemented a law called Black Zero, or a commitment to run a balanced budget. That's helped to keep its debt in check and has enabled Berlin to respond to the pandemic with ease compared to its neighbours. While Germans are richer than their European neighbours, the country's spending on infrastructure and green transformation is lagging behind many G7 nations. Let's discuss the challenges for the new chancellor. Joining me is Stefan Kuths, research director at the Kiel Institute for the World Economy. I'd like to start by reading you a quote, Mr. Kuths. Goldman Sachs says Germany has fallen behind in the modernization of its economy. The Deutsche Bank says Germany is falling behind as a research and innovation powerhouse. What are your thoughts on that?
I would say this is only half true. If we look at R&D expenditure in the private sector and the corporate sector, there Germany still holds a very strong position. Also, the professional education system is clearly an important pillar of the economy, which is still working very well. But, and here the two quotes are correct, there are some weaknesses, in particular when we talk about the coverage of high-speed internet access, in particular in the mobile sector. There is still room for maneuver, but we also have to say that the situation there is improving gradually only, but it is improving.
What impact has the Black Zero rule had, do you think, always keeping one eye on the budget deficit?
The balanced budget is not hindering Germany from investing. We have seen almost record high levels of government investment being in line with the so-called Black Zero. It's a question of setting the right priorities. What is actually expanding massively in Germany is our items in the budget, which have a lot to do with the spending for social support programs. We are an aging population, therefore the pension system absorbs more and more funds. This is a problem, but the debt brake or the black zero is not preventing the German government from investing more aggressively if they want to.
Has Germany grown too dependent on its trade with China? And could it be hamstrung looking ahead as the US looks to counter China? How do you think that's going to play out?
The situation becomes more and more difficult, in particular if we see something like a second Cold War between the United States and China. So it would be a huge problem for German exporters, but not only for exporters, but for corporates in general, because China today is already a very important production hub for Germany-based companies. And therefore, it would be extremely difficult if German companies would face a situation where they have to decide between making business with the US or making business with China. Therefore, they will try to find a way to reconcile the one with the other. But the situation is becoming more difficult than it has been in the past. This is for sure.
How do you see Angela Merkel's legacy? How do you think she'll be remembered?
It's a difficult question to answer in a couple of seconds only. So to put it in a nutshell, I would say that as a crisis manager, she did quite a good job bringing all parties around one table. But if we look at the fundamental decisions that had been taken, there are a lot of question marks remain, in particular with the setup of the European Monetary Union, which is still in very difficult conditions. Also, the energy transformation of the economy was not successful, and we are still waiting for a pension reform that is urgently needed, and it was clear that it is needed for many years. So very few important reforms were pushed through during her government period of 16 years. So I would say the overall assessment is very, very mixed.
Okay, let's talk about the Eurozone. Ultimately, it was Mario Draghi who, despite opposition from Bundesbank, calmed fears and some would say ultimately saved the euro. Do you think that Angela Merkel's tacit support for Bundesbank's opposition to bailing out Greece might have led to the breakup of the union had louder voices not prevailed?
I would say that Germany didn't play a very helpful role here because they tried to keep the European Monetary Union together at any cost. And by so doing, they gave up important principles, in particular the principle that there should not be a debt union within the monetary union. But this is crucial for fiscal discipline on the level of the member states. And what we are currently observing is that the fiscal rules that had been adopted are more or less neglected by everyone. The smaller member countries are still sticking to it, but the large ones, in particular France, Italy, and others, they are more or less ignoring these rules, and it will be very, very difficult to come back to a situation or to come back to a setup of the euro area where we are playing according to rules that everyone can agree to. I would say this is the fundamental problem of the eurozone, is that there is no consensus in monetary policy making. And actually, Angela Merkel did not really say clearly what she wanted. She wanted to kind of manage the crisis somewhat, but what she did is she kicked the can down the road without really solving their underlying problems.
All right. Hey, thank you very much for your analysis there, Stefan Kuths, Research Director at the Kiel Institute for the World Economy.
My pleasure.
Afghanistan's businesses are fighting for their survival. International clients are staying away, and that's forcing firms to axe jobs. Charles Stratford in Kabul finds out why.
Nawab Niazi sold land and a home in order to start up his textile company 14 years ago. He says he has since invested $500,000 in the factory. Both Afghan and foreign companies used to buy the clothes and scarves it makes, but business has virtually ground to a halt in recent weeks. When the Taliban took control of Afghanistan in August, the US froze nearly $10 billion of Afghan assets held abroad, and Taliban leaders were forced to restrict cash withdrawals from local banks.
The Taliban government has to reopen the financial institutes so people can withdraw enough money to buy materials for their businesses. And the international community needs to soften their attitude. This stalemate badly affects everyday Afghan people.
Abdul Qadir is one of the factory's few employees who still comes to work unpaid. He fought the Soviet army when it invaded Afghanistan in the 1980s. He never dreamed he would still be struggling to support his family 40 years later.
The country is in a terrible state. The security situation has improved, but there are no jobs. There's no happiness in life, no joy. The country is a mess.
The factory employs around 30 women who work in a separate room from the men. Some employees fled the country on evacuation flights when the Taliban took control. Nawab shows me a video of men he used to pay to collect wool for him in the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif.
So we can't afford them right now.
Around 80 people are employed at this factory, but as you can see, it's just down today to a skeleton staff. And one of the big problems the company is facing is that one of its main overseas clients is refusing to buy the products that this company makes because the taxes that this company will pay on the profits that it makes now go to the new Taliban government.
Foreign companies are nervous about dealing with their Afghan business partners. That's because foreign governments won't recognize the Taliban government, as some of its members are on terrorism and UN sanction lists. 29-year-old entrepreneur Abdul Wali spent $1 million on what he says is the largest wool spinning machine in Afghanistan. He finally got it up and running 3 months ago, but was forced to suspend operations earlier this month because foreign and local clients cancelled orders and some investors fled the country with their cash.
I had big plans to buy more machinery. I am dedicated to my community, but the current situation is hopeless. All my employees are forced to sit at home because I cannot pay them.
Nawab says he wants to help his workers' families and build a new Afghanistan. For the time being, he and many Afghan business owners like him have no choice but to put their dreams on hold.
Epic, the developer of the popular Fortnite game, has been blacklisted by Apple. That after Epic took Apple to court, accusing it of abusing its App Store monopoly. Epic says Apple's charges for in-app purchases are unfair. A judge largely sided with Apple, but also in a partial win for Epic, allowed developers to use their own in-app payment systems. Apple charges 30% commission from developers like Epic to use its App Store. In 2020, it made $55 billion. It stands to lose $3.5 billion from the loss of in-app payment services, which sounds like a lot, but is only 1.2% of Apple's total revenue. But for many smaller app developers, it's a matter of survival. After being kicked off Apple's App Store, Tim Sweeney, the CEO of Epic Games, tweeted, "This is another extraordinary anti-competitive move by Apple," even after the court ruled against these allegations. Sweeney has argued the reason for challenging Apple was existential, because they wanted to create a metaverse. In simple terms, that's a platform for developers and users to earn more money for themselves. And with Apple taking 30%, that wasn't possible. That metaverse in some games allows people in some of the most impoverished parts of the world to make a living. Well, let's get some analysis on this now with Piers Harding-Rolls, Research Director of Games at Ampere Analysis. He joins me via Skype from London. Thank you very much for joining us here on Counting the Cost. So Apple's decision to kick Epic from its ecosystem, is that an overreaction?
Hello, thanks very much for having me. I don't think so. I think Apple's within its rights, obviously, to stop Epic publishing Fortnite onto its platform while the court case is going on. That's what its position it's laid out. Obviously, in the context of the consumer, I'd love to see Fortnite back on iOS. And actually, I think I'm not sure we'll be waiting a huge amount of time before we see that game back on the platform.
OK, is Tim Sweeney, Epic CEO, right, though, in calling Apple or saying Apple has a monopoly?
No, I don't think so, actually. It's really all related to market definition. So the judge laid out a market definition, and the market that it examined in the court case was really looking at mobile games transactions as the market definition. And within that context, Apple does not have a monopoly. It has, by Apple's own data of the market, around 55% share of the opportunity in that context. So it can't be described as a monopoly in that way. Epic was trying to convince the judge that the market definition was actually more narrow than that. But it didn't convince the judge in that argument.
OK, what then do you make of the court's decision? It kind of gave a win to both sides, but more in favour of Apple.
Overall, I think it's a pretty resounding defeat for Epic, really. The judge, I don't think, was that impressed by the arguments that it put forward, certainly around the idea of Apple having a monopoly. The one area that Apple was identified as being anti-competitive on was in terms of its anti-steering activity. So within its app store rules, it doesn't allow developers to actually tell the users about where they can purchase outside of the App Store ecosystem or about cheaper opportunities to do that. And the judge laid out a ruling that means that it wants Apple to allow developers to do that.
Do you think other developers will challenge Apple or develop their own in-app payment systems?
Well, the ruling stipulates that Apple must allow developers to be able to make users aware, potentially within the app, about alternative payment mechanisms if they want to implement that. So I think some of the larger developers who already have payment solutions outside of the App Store, for example, will be able to roll that out fairly easily. Smaller developers, obviously, you know, will have to go through the process of building up the capability to do that. I think the benefits are probably slightly exaggerated in terms of from the developer side, because you know, there's lots of things to think about, those additional costs of running your own payment mechanism outside of the App Store, and also things like pushing users to use those other forms of payment mechanism. And that, you know, the idea that developers will do that by potentially reducing their prices, and that obviously has a knock-on impact on the revenue streams in that context.
Obviously, developers are following this news very closely, but do you think Apple users are following this legal tussle? Do Apple users care?
Well, I think that's a good question, because Epic really was trying to present this as not just a sort of industry-focused case, but was also saying this is good for the consumer, and obviously had this whole kind of marketing effort to paint Apple as the bad guy in the context of this court case. But I don't think the average consumer really cares about what's going on in this sort of legal wrangling. I think actually when it comes down to usage of alternative payment mechanisms, if they are implemented, a lot of people will take the easy route and take the, you know, the safe route of what they're used to, so using Apple's own in-app purchase mechanism. So I don't think actually consumers are that interested in this, or that, you know, your average mainstream consumer is that interested in this or impacted by what's going on in the court case.
Okay, let's turn and talk about the metaverse, this sort of overarching term used to describe the future of the online world, I guess, where it's not just socialising online, but playing games online, owning assets online, earning real money online. Do you think that this decision by Apple will impact that at all? I mean, Tim Sweeney seems to think that it will very much impact the future of play-to-earn games.
Yes, I think there's two elements to what Epic was trying to get to, which was, one was alternative payment mechanism, but the other one, which is perhaps more important in the context of the metaverse and play-to-earn games, for example, is the ability to introduce other stores into the App Store environment and or the iOS environment. And that this case failed on that front. And I think the sort of key tenet really of play to earn experiences is really this secondary markets marketplace, where users that earn things within the game can go to those marketplaces and convert that into real money in a way, or other assets within the game. And I don't think this result of this court case changes that in any way at the moment. So I don't think that there is a significant change in the landscape for those types of experiences on iOS at the moment.
All right, thank you very much for that. Piers Harding-Rolls at Ampere Analysis.
Thank you.
Bangkok's famous nightlife is part of the reason the city has been a top tourist destination in Asia for years. But as Thailand's government works on bringing international tourists back after the pandemic, curfews are still in place and bars are closed. Scott Heidler has more from the Thai capital.
This network of alleys in Patpong, usually the vibrant center of Bangkok's unique style of nightlife, now sits idle and dark. The shutters were pulled down on bars and entertainment venues in the weeks after the first cases of COVID-19 in Thailand, and have stayed down for most of the 18 months that followed, thanks to shutdowns and curfews. This part of Chinatown is home to a community of trendy, small specialty bars. Not only do bar owners view the government's handling of their industry during the pandemic as a near-death blow, but alcohol control laws predating the shutdowns have also been working against them.
I am embarrassed about this situation. Thailand is renowned for its great nightlife. Many bars here receive awards. Why doesn't the government support the industry? I think these strange laws are supported by big business to maintain their monopoly. Our voice is not loud like theirs.
Bar owners call the laws draconian, in which alcohol sales are limited to set hours during the day, heavy taxes on imports, and unequal laws only allowing large companies to brew beer and distill alcohol. A ban on alcohol advertising and internet sales are so strictly enforced, bars were fined for posting videos of cocktail making and menus for drinks delivery. Yet large breweries avoid the ban by advertising mineral water and soda that bear the same logos as their alcohol products.
Here's an example of Thailand's alcohol control laws. If I were to take a selfie here in this bar and share it on social media, I could be fined up to $1,500 for indirectly advertising the brands of alcohol behind me. If I own the bar, I could be fined up to $15,000 and possibly face a year in jail.
Alcohol control laws have been a contentious subject in Thailand. Historically, politically connected conservative and religious groups have worked to keep them strict. An opposition member of parliament, a former bar owner himself, is working to change the laws and save smaller bars in trouble.
When we reopen again and the tourists come again, they would find out Thailand is completely different country, completely, it's not fun anymore, you know.
Yet some who support the alcohol laws say it's also about safety for visitors.
I think tourist safety should be a priority. I think alcohol control is necessary. If we let the alcohol sellers run free and do whatever they want, things will get messy.
Once Thailand emerges from its lockdown, curfews are lifted and the nightlife is allowed to reopen, it's unclear if it will return as it once was or a watered-down version.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at Kim Vinell. Do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or you can drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has entire episodes for you to catch up on. And that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Kim Vinell. From the whole team, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.